Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Pharmacy benefit managers, otherwise known as PBMs, are third-party middleman companies that manage prescription drug benefits for insurers, employers, and government programs. They have been blamed for the high cost of prescription medications in America. In this episode of Care Talk, Dr. Jeffrey Gordon from Doctors for America explains what PBMs are and what they do, and talks about the newest regulations from Congress and how that could affect your drug prices. Welcome to Care Talk Live, a weekly American healthcare policy show and podcast where we explain how healthcare works or doesn't work and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Please subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get future Care Talk episodes. In today's episode, we break down how PBMs actually work, why they're driving up your prescription costs, and what's being done to hold them accountable. So welcome to Dr. Jeffrey Gordon, a retired family physician from California and board member of Doctors for America.
Yes, good to be here, and thank you for inviting me. I want to start by saying I'm a retired family doctor after working for 40 years in direct clinical care. And I'm a board member of Doctors for America, which is a patient advocacy organization, but I'm expressing my own analysis and my own opinions. I tend to be blunt, honest, and direct, and this is a bit nerdy, so I apologize in advance. But I'd like to start with a little vignette, a sort of a case study, and I'm reading from the Salt Lake City Tribune of October 28, 2018. The Utah State Legislature required state employees' insurance plans to offer savings rewards or CAS incentives to patients who choose the cheapest quality providers. This resulted in 2018 in what was called state-sponsored pharmacy tourism. For their 160,000 employee members, the Utah Public Health Employee Plan offered patients on certain medications, plane fare to San Diego, a chauffeured limousine to Tijuana to a respected pharmacy to buy 90 days worth of medicine, chauffeured limousine back, plane fare back to Salt Lake City, and a $500 reward for their effort. This saved them $6,000 to $18,000 a prescription. I looked up yesterday to see if this was still in effect, and the pharmacy tourism option was offered mostly to people during the deductible part of their insurance, meaning that the money saved went to the patient rather than the insurance company, in addition to the benefits I recently described. They offered to keep the patient and a partner overnight at a hotel in San Diego and have raised the payment for this to $750. That shows you how absurd the American health system is. Now, you have to understand that pharmacy takes up about 8% of the $5.6 trillion spent on personal health care in the United States each year. And prescription drugs totally are about 20% of all health care costs. So this is no small matter. Pharmacy benefit managers have been greatly consolidated in the last 25, 30 years. And three of them cover 80% of all prescriptions in the United States. And those three are vertically integrated with huge medical provider corporations. That means these corporations include insurance companies, medical providers, pharmacy benefits, and other healthcare resources. So we have CVS Caremark, which is about 34% of all prescriptions. CVS Caremark is a pharmacy firm that had enough money to buy Aetna health insurance. So they include an insurance plan. The second largest PBM is owned by Cigna Group, and they call their PBM Evernorth. And they cover about 23% of all American prescriptions. The third one is the United Health Group, and their pharmacy benefit manager is called Optimum Rx, and they cover 22%. Now, this vertical integration allows PBMs were set up as administrative agencies to really manage the payment to insurance companies from pharmacies and from insurance companies to pharmacies for an individual prescription, basically an accounting mechanism. But what we're seeing in the United States today is that these agencies, the PBMs, have expanded their purview to what I would not sarcastically call criminal syndicates. In fact, PBMs were first founded in the 1960s to do this, promoting cost reduction, saying they would negotiate discounts from both drug manufacturers and pharmacies and pass them on to patients. So in the 1990s, mergers put the PBMs in the hands of the pharmacy manufacturer corporations, and the pharmacy manufacturer manipulated the prices of their PBM so much that the Federal Trade Commission cracked down in 1997 and asked all these conglomerates to disband. Then what happened was that in 2003, after Medicare had been in place for 38 years, Washington, its wisdom, finally decided that it ought to pay for prescription drugs, oh my God, under the Republican administration of President George W. Bush. A law was passed that created Medicare Part D. Now, it had three outstanding characteristics which are very important to this story. Number one, they decided that Medicare could not negotiate drug prices. Number two, the insurance plan created had what was called the donut hole, which was in the middle of the year when you spent so much money, your insurance dropped out entirely and you were fully responsible for prescription costs completely out of your own pocket. And thirdly, they decided that Medicare Part D would not be integrated into government programming, but be in a private market and set up separate insurance companies that would insure pharmaceutical benefits. And this reawakened the PBM as the intermediary between insurance programs and pharmacies, and they had really only one functionality that was really basic, which was claims processing. So claims processing would be about 14 to 20 cents per prescription, And that was their basic source of income. But pharmacy benefit managers, being entrepreneurial for-profit corporations, did what was legally sanctioned by the federal government, and which I consider to be virtually a criminal conspiracy. And it started with the pharmacy benefit managers saying to the pharmaceutical firms, "We'll put your medicine on the insurance company's formulary if you kind of pay us a little money." And in ordinary parlance, that was called a kickback or a bribe. But as soon as it got to be traditional to do this, all of a sudden these payments were called rebates. And rebates became ubiquitous in the pharmacy market. In a real charitable, caring world, the PBMs might have passed these savings or rebates or money transfers onto the payments to patients, but in fact, they ended up keeping all this money for themselves. And so that was their first kind of exploitative acquisition of money. The second thing, way they made money, was called the pharmacy squeeze or the spread. PBMs use maximum account allowable cost lists, which determine what employers can charge for drugs and what to pay pharmacies. And the actual number is hidden from the pharmacies, from the insurance company, and from the employees. So the pharmacists have no idea how much money they'll make on the sale until the moment they sell a prescription. And then the PBMs have algorithms that juggle these rates, and there is definitely a squeeze or a spread between what they say they need a discount from the pharmacy manufacturers and what they say they are required to be reimbursed by the insurance companies. And again, the PBMs in this Byzantine system get to keep the extra profits for themselves. None of it is passed on to patients. The fourth way that PBMs distort patient care is they require, through the insurance companies, to direct the patients to certain preferred pharmacy networks. Again, this is rationalized as preventing waste, fraud, and abuse, but really it does really pad the pockets of the insurance companies, who in each case not only own the insurance company, the PBM, but also own much of the pharmacy networks. And then there's another even more bizarre iteration of this called direct and indirect remuneration fees. So after a pharmacy benefit manager pays a pharmacy for filling a prescription, months later it can claw back money from the pharmacy by claiming it did not meet certain quality indicators over which the pharmacy has no control. The criteria for these indicators are often proprietary and kept secret. So these PBMs are corporations sitting between an insurance company, a pharmacy manufacturer, and the pharmacist, and they have devised all these ways to make money, none of which impact or are of any benefit to the patient who needs a prescription, the doctor who prescribed the prescription, and so on. And this this complex system has made billions of dollars for the PBMs. A Federal Trade Commission evaluation showed that over a three-year period, on two prescriptions for cancer drugs alone, the PBM made $1.8 billion in profit. So that this is a huge money-making machine that has accrued no benefit to patients whatsoever. Now, I go on to the law that was passed, which curtailed this and said the PBMs have to have a fixed add-on charge for managing the transfer of the prescription, it did nothing to change what President Biden's FTC started to do, was to break up the vertical integration of these into healthcare systems to make them more easily exploit patients. So they have treated the symptoms and the superficial problems, but under the Trump administration, they dropped the idea, which the FTC did in prior years, which to break up these conglomerates altogether. Mm-hmm. So all of this happens out of the sight of the patient. You have no control over it. It takes away savings that you would have had, but there's nothing you can do about it.
That's grim. So these PBMs, they are delivering enormous profits for the insurers and larger companies that they're a part of. Congress has, as you mentioned, Congress is starting to regulate, but they haven't really done enough to rein in all the abuses that you talked about. Why is that? And when will Congress do something about this?
Oh, well, the answer for that is easy. PBMs have lobbyists. And the fact is that all this exists. I could give you a list of the states. Probably 10 or 15 states have sued PBMs and won $1 million in penalties because the PBMs were proven to skim money off them and overcharge the states on like Medicaid or something like that. State after state has won these lawsuits. And Lisa Kahn at the Federal Trade Commission did an extensive study and showed it was in the process of breaking up these conglomerates when the administration changed. And now the FTC has different policy. So the lobbyists run the FTC now. The breaking up of the conspiratorial syndicate was not done. But now Congress and the people congressmen are getting such irate feedback from the field about pharmacy benefits that they have to do something. So they've skimmed off the easy problem at the top of the process.
And the issue, or one of the issues with pharmacy benefit managers making so much money off of insurance companies or whatever, is that we all pay higher drug prices because of it, right? Their gigantic profits are funded by overcharging people.
Right. The basic thing is, if a PBM negotiated a lower price from a manufacturer, they should pass it on to the patient, but they haven't. They've collected and saved all that money for themselves. If they passed it on, you would get lower premiums on your insurance or lower cost when you bought a drug. But those things are not occurring routinely, ubiquitously across the United States for virtually everyone.
Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out before, the reason why insurance companies aren't doing anything about the fact that the PBMs are sucking up all this money off of insurance companies is because they're all the same thing. They're all owned by these giant conglomerates, and they're benefiting from this.
Oh, I'd make it more strict than that. The PBM is the make money arm, wholly integrated and part and parcel. It's a department. Of 80% of the PBMs are departments of insurance companies. They're the let's make a bit extra money. So the Affordable Care Act limited what's called the overhead and administrative costs of insurance companies and promoted maximum what they call medical loss ratios. That is money devoted to medical care. But if you're an insurance company and you have a PBM, you can shuffle some of your profit to the PBM by overcharging yourself for pharmaceuticals. And that way, money that you made exploiting patients for medical care, you can take it off the books and put it on the books of the PBM and therefore qualify not to be penalized under the Affordable Care Act. So the vertical integration, that's another major part of the scam that the recent congressional laws did not eliminate altogether at all.
Well, thank you very much for enlightening us about PBMs today. And we'll hopefully have better news in the future of something will be done about PBMs.
I could say the only way to do that is to be an involved citizen and advocate for the health of you and your family. And not stand for this kind of actual criminal activity endorsed by federal legislation.
Thank you. And just a reminder to our audience, we have free or low-cost healthcare resources available on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. So check it out. And please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. And now our experts will answer your health insurance questions. So welcome to Louise Norris, Health Insurance and Healthcare Reform Analyst at healthinsurance.org, and Diane Archer, the founder of Just Care and Senior Advisor on Medicare to Social Security Works. So let's start with Diane. As Medicare Advantage open enrollment continues through the end of March, why should people consider switching plans? And can't you save a lot of money in a Medicare Advantage plan?
Excellent question. I think it's fair to say that it might look as if you can save money in a Medicare Advantage plan, but there's a lot of cost in so doing. So if you're in a Medicare Advantage plan, you should absolutely consider switching to traditional Medicare, the government administered health plan under Medicare, during this Medicare Advantage open enrollment period, which ends at the end of March. Even though you do pay, as you say, Laura, less upfront for Medicare Advantage than for traditional Medicare, in Medicare Advantage, you're always gambling with your health and sometimes with your life. And let me explain why. As we all know, we all want health insurance because we don't know what the future holds for us in terms of the health care that we're going to need. So today we might be completely healthy. Tomorrow we might fall on the ice and break several bones and need very costly health care. And good health insurance should cover that care that's medically necessary if that's the care that your treating physician says you need. The issue with Medicare Advantage is that the insurers operating these plans are for profit, and they profit most when they can delay and deny care. So as a result, they have AI in place and teams of clinicians in place to second guess your treating physicians, not being on the ground with you, but they're basically to figure out ways, in some instances, not to cover the care you need. So there are mountains and mountains of Medicare Advantage horror stories where people needed care quickly, needed care because they had cancer, and weren't able to get that care in a timely fashion, because that's how the insurers save money and profit. If you're in traditional Medicare, which is, as I mentioned, administered by the federal government, you're guaranteed coverage from the doctors you know and trust. It's a public program, it's not for profit, and it puts the care of its enrollees first. With Medicare Advantage, again, because corporate health insurers administer the program, you are in a very different situation where the incentive financially for these insurers is to delay and deny costly care inappropriately and to keep you from seeing the physicians and hospitals that you want to see to treat your condition. Now, let me add one more thing. It is absolutely the case that all Medicare Advantage plans are different. And so there are ones that are much worse than others. The problem is that it's just impossible to tell which ones will give you the care you need and which ones won't. One study found that the worst performing Medicare Advantage plans were responsible for literally tens of thousands of needless deaths each year. But again, you can't know which plans are the ones that you should avoid and which are the ones that you should enroll in. There is a 5-star rating program, and that is one way that people try to distinguish the better Medicare Advantage plans from the ones that are not as good. And the problem there is that the star rating program is a bit of a farce because it doesn't rate plans based on either the adequacy of their provider networks or on the rates at which they deny and delay care. So you could have a five-star plan that is denying care, you know, 30% of the time, and they would still get five stars for other metrics that they do well on. Same with the four-star plans. So while I would never recommend that you enroll in a one, two, or three-star plan, there's no telling whether the four and five-star plans will actually give you the care you need either. Again, there have been multiple studies of Medicare Advantage plans, two by the Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Health and Human Services, that found in both instances widespread and persistent inappropriate delays and denials of care in Medicare Advantage. Again, the Office of the Inspector General didn't name names. And of course, things are always changing in Medicare Advantage. So a plan that may not be good today could be better tomorrow or vice versa. So nothing is constant. So back to your original question, Laura, about, you know, Medicare Advantage plans costing less. Yes, up front, they cost less than traditional Medicare, because with traditional Medicare, there is no out-of-pocket limit, which means that if you want to avoid out-of-control costs, you need to buy supplemental coverage. Now, often that coverage isn't available once you've been in Medicare Advantage for more than a year. And even when it is available, it's often very, very expensive. So most people with little disposable income enroll in Medicare Advantage to save money up front. The problem is when you need care in Medicare Advantage, you may end up having to pay a very large amount out of pocket because your care is denied, because your care is delayed, because you can't see the doctors you need to see for your condition. Let me end by saying right now that it's wealthy people who are enrolling in Medicare, the traditional Medicare program, because they know that's the program where they can be sure to get the care they need when they need it. It's there for you when you need costly care. But with Medicare Advantage, that's not the case. And so right now, a bunch of policy experts have all come together to make the case to members of Congress that the number one priority they should all have when it comes to Medicare is to put an out-of-pocket cap onto traditional Medicare, as there is with Medicare Advantage. That out-of-pocket limit would make it easy for people then to enroll in traditional Medicare without the need for buying Medicare supplemental coverage. They would have that protection that they have in Medicare Advantage, and they would also have something they don't have in Medicare Advantage, which is access to almost all doctors and hospitals anywhere in the country, and coverage for the care their treating physicians believe they need without the kind of delays people in Medicare Advantage too often face. So if you want to be in traditional Medicare, the government-administered program, reach out to your members of Congress and talk to them and tell them that right now you do not have an affordable choice of traditional Medicare, that you don't have a meaningful choice between Medicare Advantage and traditional Medicare, that you're locked into Medicare Advantage unless you're willing to take a major financial risk in traditional Medicare or you're able to buy supplemental coverage.
Thank you, Diane. Our next question is from Thinking Man on Reddit, who said that my wife's the most calm and collected person I know, but Cigna and United Healthcare customer service finally broke her. My wife gave birth to our first child and she had United Healthcare. I'm on Cigna. Added baby to my Cigna shortly after birth. But nearly 4 months later and close to 20 calls later, the baby's delivery claim is still denied by Cigna. Cigna and United Healthcare are fighting. They're saying they haven't received the charges. Hospital can't do anything. They're pointing fingers, and neither one is helping this family. So, Louise, do you have any thoughts or suggestions?
Yes. Yeah. So this is, I'm so sorry, thinking, man, that your family is going through this, because I know how frustrating this is. Like, you have the insurance, they're supposed to coordinate benefits when there's two plans, and it sounds like this is not happening the way it's supposed to work. Probably the easiest first thing to do is to contact human resources at both your employer and your wife's employer. I assume these are employer-sponsored plans, and talk to them, because I mean, that is their job and they're very good at it, and they know who to contact at the insurance companies or the health plan administrator. They may just be able to sort it out on your behalf. If they can't, the next thing I would recommend is trying to set up a conference call where you have representatives from both Cigna and United Healthcare and the hospital billing department all on the phone at one time, because it's a lot harder for them to keep passing the buck if they're all on the call. If you just call up one and then they just tell you, oh, it's the hospital's problem or it's the other insurance company's problem, then you know you're the one chasing down all the loose ends. So trying to get them all on a call together might help. If that still fails, you can file a complaint with either your state insurance department or the federal Department of Labor. It depends on what kind of plans these are. The majority, about two-thirds of people who have employer-sponsored health insurance are actually in self-insured plans. And people don't always realize this, because when you look at your ID card, you know, the coverage ID card, it still has an insurance company's name on there, but that company is just administering the benefits, and your employer is actually the one, it's their money being used to pay the claims. That is the majority of plans, and those plans are not regulated at the state level. They're regulated by the U.S. Department of Labor instead. So if your employer tells you that they buy their insurance from an insurance company, from, in this case, Cigna or United Healthcare, the state regulates that plan, and you can contact your state insurance department and file a complaint, and they have a whole complaint resolution process they can go through. But if you're amongst the two-thirds of workers whose plan is self-insured, that's where the federal government, that's where you file complaints. But hopefully your human resources department can address it before it has to get to that level. Because if your employer is paying an insurance company to administer their benefits and they're causing problems with the administration, what you've described here is just a problem with the coordination of benefits, your employer can hopefully reach out to the insurer and get the situation sorted out on your behalf. If all of that fails, another alternative is contacting your members of Congress. And if, depending on how you feel about it, reaching out to the media. That, you know, your mileage will vary there, obviously, and some people don't feel like sharing their personal story on the media, but we have certainly seen cases where doing that does help to sort of shame the parties involved into sorting it out and coming to a resolution. So that's kind of your list of things you can choose to do, in order from where I would start on down. Best of luck and congratulations on the baby.
Thank you, Louise. And thank you, everyone, for joining us to learn more about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America. Be sure to check out more free or low-cost healthcare resources on our website at healthcarevoices.org/caretalk. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next week for more Care Talk. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.